PR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Former French Finance Minister Christine Lagarde begins her job today as head of the International Monetary Fund. Eleanor Beardsley reports Lagarde is the first woman ever to hold that post.
Christine Lagarde was picked by consensus by the IMF's 24-member board, beating out Mexican central banker Agustín Carstens. The post became vacant after the resignation of Dominique Strauss-Kahn following his arrest in New York in May on charges of sexual assault. The first task of Lagarde's five-year term will be to deal with the efforts of the IMF and the European Union to resolve the Greek debt crisis and prevent contagion to other Eurozone economies. Before becoming French finance minister, Lagarde spent two decades as an antitrust lawyer in the United States.
I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from LendingTree, providing multiple loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, both programs come from the Focus Archives. The first show originally broadcast in May, so as you listen, do keep in mind that this morning, both hours will not be taking calls. Over 9 million soldiers were killed in World War I. 21 million were wounded. It was the costliest war that the world had ever seen. Yet when the fighting began, the leaders of Europe thought it might be over in a matter of months, if not weeks. Looking back, so many people have asked the same question. Why did so many nations get caught up in this violence? In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Adam Hochschild about his new book, To End All Wars, and it is a history of World War I. We'll try to explore some of the causes of the war, how it was fought, and also one particular aspect of the story that he says interests him, and that is the struggle between those people who felt that war was something noble and necessary and those people who felt it was absolute madness. And it is true that there were people who opposed the war. It might have been small compared to the number who supported it, but indeed there were people who protested and opposed the war. And we'll talk some about that. The book, To End All Wars, has just recently been published. Houghton Mifflin is the publisher. People, I think, will know Adam Hochschild for his book, King Leopold's Ghost. This was a book about the conquest and colonization of the Congo by Belgium's King Leopold II. Our guest teaches writing at UC Berkeley and the Graduate School of Journalism. He's joining us this morning by phone. And Mr. Hochschild, hello.
Hi, David. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. You know, it's certainly hard to grasp the carnage involved in this war. That when you look at the total numbers of people, combatants who were killed, that's a truly stunning number. It's maybe even a little bit more stunning when you take a look at individual countries and realize just how big a segment of their populations that were made up of young men in their prime died.
Absolutely. I mean, the toll is just unimaginable compared to what Europe had known before this. The toll of the First World War was more than six times that of the previous most deadly war, the Napoleonic Wars, which stretched over a much longer period of time. Little Serbia, for example, 20% of the population, military and civilian, were killed. One out of every five people living in the country. In France, out of all men who were between 20 and 32 in 1914 at the start of the war, one half were dead when it was over, and many of the remainder horribly wounded, you know, missing hands, arms, legs, genitals, eyes. It was an enormous death toll.
Mm. And it also, interestingly, too, was no respecter of social class, because a lot of people who were from the elite classes of these countries died in very large numbers.
Yeah, this to me is one of the particularly interesting and haunting things about the war, because in most countries, most times, the elites are very good at getting the poor to do the dying for them. If you look at America's recent wars, for example, in Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, you don't find any senators' sons or CEOs' sons among those who are dying there. Very few Ivy Leaguers and so forth. It's mostly the poor, small-town folk, and so on. But in the First World War, it was the exact opposite, because it was traditional in all of the principal warring countries for the upper classes, the aristocracy, to go into the army. And it was those young officers, captains and lieutenants, who led their men out of the trenches, walking forward across no man's land so that they could be mowed down by the machine guns of the other side. And the death tolls among those elites were just enormous. For example, one of the great British landed families, the Cecil family, patriarch of the family, Lord Salisbury, was Prime Minister of England for many years at the turn of the century. He had 10 grandsons. 5 of them were killed in the war, and one of them, one of those, George Cecil, was actually a character in my book. Men who graduated from Oxford in 1913, 31% died. Graduates of Eton, Britain's most exclusive private school, there were more than 30 Eton graduates killed in a single day, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And that list of statistics could just go on, and the same thing applied in all the other countries.
Yeah. I'm not sure when the prior to World War One, when the last conflict of a continental with continental dimensions would have been. I think probably it would have been the Napoleonic Wars.
Right.
So that means then you're looking at from roughly a century from Waterloo to the beginning of World War One. So, but it. Even though that you're talking about 100 years, I think that probably there were a lot of people who, going into World War One, their mindset, what they thought that war was all about and how it would be fought and the sort of glories that attached, they were still thinking about Napoleonic warfare.
Or I think more to the point, they were thinking about the wars that had been in their own experience, which were colonial wars.
Yeah.
Because many British, French, and German officers had had combat experience prior to 1914, but it had been fighting colonial wars in Africa and Asia where they were conquering new territory or putting down rebellions in colonies that they had, where they were the ones who had the machine guns, the repeating rifles, modern weaponry. And the Africans and Asians they were fighting against usually didn't have any of this stuff. And as a result, these were wars where they suffered relatively few casualties, came home covered with glory, getting promotions and so forth. And this was what they expected when they went into battle in 1914.
They weren't thinking about the fact that their adversary would be as well armed as they.
Exactly. And so you see, you know, the absurdity, for example, of sending huge numbers of cavalry to the front in 1914. I mean, can you imagine the total, utter uselessness of a massive cavalry charge against a single machine gun, which can fire, you know, 500 bullets a minute? The horse, you know, is useless against something like that. But the Germans, when they invaded France in 1914, had 8 cavalry divisions, 40,000 horses. And of course, in the first month or two, everybody discovered that, you know, this was not going to be a war where there were going to be massive cavalry charges, although it didn't prevent the British, at least, from continuing to keep those cavalry divisions on the ready behind the lines for most of the war.
Yeah. Something else, yet another thing that I think contributes here and that perhaps also is difficult to understand but probably important to understand is that a lot of people at the time apparently had this feeling that the advanced societies, the industrialized countries of Europe had become soft, and that what these societies needed to toughen them up was a nice little war. And that they actually had this idea that the experience of going through a war, of course, not the war that they actually got, you know, who knows what actually they were thinking of, but that experience would actually be good, would be a positive thing for these societies.
That's right. You can find people on both sides saying this. You know, people who ought to know better, like the novelist, the great novelist Thomas Mann in Germany, all sorts of similar writers in England, you know, Kipling, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and so forth. They thought war was a tonic. They thought it would stiffen people up. And here again, they were sort of thinking about the colonial wars where, you know, you sent your sons off to battle, and they didn't all come home in coffins, but they came home, you know, with glory, with medals, with promotions, with the experience of combat in a foreign country. I think it's always tempting when any country goes to war to imagine that it's going to be...
Participating in the test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
And is out now if you'd like to read it. And questions are welcome too. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, here you can start by thinking about some of the things that you've talked about here already. You can start to get yourself perhaps into the mindset, or that you can understand a little bit of the mindset of the people. At the same time, I still think, and I'm sure many people think, that they look at what happened, how the war started with this little spark of this assassination in the Balkans, and still ask this question, well, now, wait a minute. You really mean to tell me this thing that happened in this corner of Europe truly drew in all of the major powers, Germany, France, Russia, Britain, Italy, other countries, and that we ended up grinding through this four-year war? Millions of people were killed just because Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated. You still have to say that just doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But just the way an enormous forest fire can arise from, you know, one spark, so this war did arise from, or at least was ignited by the strange chain of events that began with that assassination. There were some tensions in Europe. There had been a naval arms race between Britain and Germany. All of the major countries were spending 5 or 6% of their national budgets, their gross national product, on military expenditures. There was a system of rival alliances, Germany and Austria-Hungary being closely allied, France and Russia being closely allied, with a sort of under-the-table understanding that Britain would come in on France's side if France was attacked. So these things were in the background, even though in the summer of 1914, all of the major powers were getting along with each other rather well. But this system of rival alliances committed any of the countries involved to come to the aid of one of the others if they were attacked. And there were some imperial ambitions involved. Austria-Hungary, for example, was very eager to crush the independent country of Serbia, because there were a lot of ethnic Serbs within the borders of this creaky multi-ethnic empire of Austria-Hungary. And they saw, the rulers of that empire in Vienna saw the very existence of the independent nation of Serbia as a threat, and they had been making plans to invade it and dismember it. Well, the assassination of the Archduke gave them the excuse, even though the Archduke's assassin was an Austro-Hungarian citizen, and there's no evidence that the Serbian cabinet knew anything about the assassination plot, but it gave them the excuse they'd been waiting for. So they moved to make war on Serbia, and actually those were the first actual shots of the First World War. Mm-hmm. Serbia, in turn, turned to its fellow Slavic nation, Russia, and appealed to the Tsar of Russia. In your Slav heart, was a message from the Serbian government, come to our defense. Russia began making moves of that sort. France was allied with Russia. Germany had long been hankering for a war against Russia. A lot of ethnic feeling against the Slavs. They were worried that Russia's population was much larger and felt that sooner or later there would have to be a contest between the two nations for the mastery of Eastern Europe. One thing led to another, and the whole continent went up in flames.
Yeah. I hope that I won't be accused of being somehow either pro-British or anti-German, but it seems kind of hard not to see Germany here as a key player. Certainly the Germans had ambitions to empire. It seems that they were a little more than a little envious of the British and their empire. As you say, they had a profound mistrust of Russia, despite the fact that the Kaiser and the Tsar, Willie and Nicky, were cousins.
Indeed, they were cousins who wrote to each other in English, which was the language that they had in common.
How much responsibility for the war do we put on Germany?
I think we put a lot on Germany, Germany and Austria-Hungary. I do think that they bear the prime responsibility for starting this. And I think that's what most historians today feel. At the time of the war itself, of course, it's funny, the pendulum on this has swung back and forth. At the time of the war itself, each side naturally blamed the other, and Germany said it was just fighting in its own defense, which is what most countries usually say when they go to war. The Allies, of course, blamed the Germans for starting it. After the war, there was such revulsion at the enormous death toll that there were a lot of writers who blamed both sides. And now, gradually, the pendulum has swung back. Especially since the 1960s when a German historian, Fritz Fischer, discovered a lot of previously undisclosed documents in the German archives, which really made clear Germany's imperial ambitions. But the Allies were not blameless. You know, Britain and France were allied with the one remaining absolute monarchy in Europe, the Russian Empire, which was certainly no paragon of democracy at all. And once the war was underway, each side was greedily eyeing the other side's colonies. Germany came up with a plan for snatching British and French colonies in Africa so they would have an unbroken swath of territory across the middle of the continent. The British were so eager to acquire territory that Germany and its allies possessed that they set up in the cabinet a territorial desiderata committee to figure out exactly which territory they wanted most to acquire after the war. One of those territories actually were the provinces of Ottoman Turkey that were cobbled together as the British Protectorate of Iraq.
Yeah, yes, indeed. You have to acknowledge, in fact, that the British were not only interested in maintaining their empire but enlarging it. And they also had that, again, despite the fact that the Kaiser and the King were cousins, there was this profound mistrust of Germany. And I think the British, for their part, saw Germany as being the evil empire of the day.
Mm-hmm. They did. But they still wanted the territory that Germany's allies in particular possessed. Mm-hmm.
Our guest again this hour is Adam Hochschild. We're talking about World War I, the subject of his new book, To End All Wars. We have some callers here and would certainly welcome others. And we will start out by talking with somebody here locally in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Whenever World War I is talked about, I always like to remind people that and I understand your book is partially a narrative of opposition to the war in England. Well, Bryant, Secretary of State Bryant, resigned off of it. It would have been like Powell resigning off the attack on Iraq, it seems to me, to a large extent. And from your earlier writing about the colonial heritage of Europe, it really was a colonial war for the future Lebensraum. I don't know if that term was used in Germany. We know it from the war that's called the Good War later, but it was who was going to be dominant in this hegemony of nation states and empires. So I wanted to start on that a bit, and also this idea of the opposition in England. to the war that we don't hear about much. I guess the last Australian victim of the war or participant died, so all of the Anglo-Saxon participants don't have any veterans left, so maybe we can actually talk about it without feeling like we're just spoiling the heritage of the, or the legacy of the warriors, if you get my drift. Thank you.
Well, actually, the last known combat veteran of World War One, as you say, did die a couple of days ago. Claude Chules, I believe, was his name, lived in Australia. But I don't think he would mind us talking about the war as an imperial contest at all. He was so anti-militarist after he retired from the military that he, for many years, refused to take part in Remembrance Day parades. The last known combat veteran in Britain who died a year or two ago was so much a pacifist at the time of his death that, following his wishes, his family had Where Have All the Flowers Gone played at his funeral, and they had German as well as British soldiers taking part in his honor guard. So a lot of these centenarian veterans who survived to a ripe old age were not militaristic types at all, which perhaps is a good point to let me say something about one thing I'm trying to do in this book, which is to highlight the opposition to the war that existed while it was going on. In all of the principal warring countries, there were people who felt this war is madness, it's not being fought for any useful purpose, it's not worth dying in, and who refused to fight. There were people who went to jail in Germany, in the United States, in Britain, in Russia. I focus on Britain in the book because it had the largest and most interesting anti-war movement. It didn't prevail, but they were a remarkable bunch of people. More than 20,000 men of military age refused to go into the British Army as a matter of principle. And as a matter of principle, many of them also refused the alternative service that was offered to conscientious objectors, you know, driving an ambulance at the front or working in a war industry or something. More than 6,000 were sent to prison under very harsh conditions, bare-bones diet, rule of silence, hard labor. The largest group of people who had ever, up to that point in time, been imprisoned for political reasons in a Western democracy. So, in part, this book is their story and the story of this division within one country, England, between people who thought the war was a noble and necessary crusade and people who thought it was madness and should be resisted.
Well, certainly there were people who opposed the war on religious grounds, who would have opposed any war. But there were people here whose opposition was maybe more of a pragmatic or a political nature, who would not have thought of themselves or refer to themselves as pacifists, who under certain other conditions they would say, well, we would have to go to war. How many people were there, and who were they who were making the argument that they opposed the war simply because they said this war doesn't make any sense? It's not that we shouldn't fight any war, it's just this particular war doesn't make any sense.
Well, interestingly, Britain had a surprisingly liberal conscientious objector law. You could apply for status as a conscientious objector both on religious grounds or on political grounds. A majority of people, most of them Quakers, applied on religious grounds, saying we're opposed to war as a matter of religion. And a majority also cited political grounds, usually saying, I'm an international socialist and I don't want to fight against my brethren in other countries. And I think people for whom that was the principal motivation felt this is a war where both sides claim to be fighting for civilization, for honor, for, you know, against barbarism and so forth, but neither side had the moral high ground. Britain and France were, of course, democracies of a sort, but they were allied with Tsarist Russia, which was the last absolute monarchy in Europe. So you couldn't claim for being, you were fighting for democracy there. Both sides had colonies in Africa, which they treated rather badly. No democracy there. So people felt, you know, why should I die when there isn't a great principle at stake here?
Some other callers. Bement is next, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. This is a good show because I've been a fan of World War One and done a lot of research. A couple of quick points. One, the Tsar was raised by his father to believe king, in order to be really the ruler of a country, had to fight wars. So that started the whole thing. Plus, he had a kind of an inferiority complex because of his injured, I think it was his left arm.
You're thinking of Kaiser Wilhelm, not the Tsar.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Also, he was extremely jealous because he was felt he was never accepted by all the other powers. And he was probably the only king, czar, kaiser to never be invited to Paris. He was upset. Anyway, that's part of the whole complex issue, too. He also thought it was going to be a very quick war so he could earn, quote, honor and get out of it. Anyway, enjoying the show.
Thanks.
Talk to you later.
Well, I certainly do think that it is true, particularly for Nicholas and Wilhelm, that they were both men who felt felt more comfortable in military settings and with other soldiers than they did with civilians, and that there was perhaps also in people of those classes there was a certain fascination, an almost childish fascination, I think, with the military and the trappings of military life.
Very much so. Kaiser Wilhelm had spent part of his youth as an officer in an elite regiment, and he looked back on that fondly all his life. He wore military regalia, military uniforms at all times, except when he went hunting. And he did have, as your caller said, something of an inferiority complex. Germany was the largest and economically most powerful country in Western Europe, yet the Kaiser felt it wasn't accorded the prestige that should have gone with that position. Germany had also gotten into the race for colonies in Africa a little bit later than Britain and France and didn't have as many and felt he felt restless and ambitious on that score. Russia, the story was somewhat different. Tsar Nicholas II of Russia was the absolute monarch of a country which had recently been humiliated in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905, which the Japanese won soundly and sank virtually the entire Russian fleet. Very humiliating defeat. And the idea of a European power being defeated by Asians just seemed horrendous to people in Russia. And so Russia and the Russian military were very, very eager to prove, you know, their honor and that they could come to the aid of their ally France and that they could be depended on to fight like other European countries. So I think that was one incentive that made the Russian government very eager to go to war.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to reflect on the role particularly that the nobility and particularly in Germany and Russia played. First of all, everybody was all related, and that had something to do with, I think, the idea that Victoria and Albert had, that if the royal families of Europe were all closely connected, that would be good for the peace and stability of Europe. As it turned out, that wasn't quite the case. But that particularly in Germany and Russia, I think that the Kaiser and the Tsar had a kind of authority that the King of England didn't really have, and that made it possible for them to be much more involved, I think, in military affairs than George or his father were.
That's certainly true because, you know, Britain was very much a constitutional monarchy, and by this point in time, Parliament definitely was vastly more powerful than the king. The king had some influence in making senior army appointments and so forth, but it was really Parliament and the cabinet that decided things. Germany was much more of a mixed story where the Kaiser still, although there was a German Parliament, the Kaiser still had a great deal of power. And in Russia, the Tsar possessed virtually total power.
The guest in this part of Focus is Adam Hochschild. He is the author of a book that a lot of people know, King Leopold's Ghost, that was a history of the Belgian Congo. He's also written about the anti-slavery movement in the British Empire in his book, Bury the Chains. He has a new book out that is a history of World War I. The title is To End All Wars, and it is published by Houghton Mifflin. Questions are welcome. In fact, we have quite a few. We'll try to get everybody in, but of course, callers can help us by being brief when they get on and make their comments. So we'll go back to the phones. And the next person in line, I believe, is in Champaign and line number three. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I wonder if we could refer, I don't think it's too much off topic, but if we could refer back to Serbia, this might sound anti-Serb, which I'm not, but I understood that this Colonel Apis person who was the head of the Secret Service in Serbia gave the revolvers to and was involved in the assassination plot. If you could touch on that. And the other thing was that it's interesting that although Serbia wasn't looking for a war especially, they were very imperialistic. They had designs on Bosnia-Herzegovina, and then when that fell through, they planned to go south and, create a greater Serbia. And if you just touch on those two subjects, I'll listen offline. Thank you very much.
All right.
Well, you're right. The person you mentioned, Colonel Apis, or Apis, who was head of Serbian Secret Service, is thought to have had connections with the assassination plotters. But there's still no evidence that the actual cabinet of Serbia knew about this or approved the plan. That's never surfaced. What kind of imperial designs Serbia had? I'm sure, there were many, ethnic Serb nationalists who dreamed of various combinations of Greater Serbia, a sort of pan-Slavic federation, and so forth. But Serbia at that time still was a relatively small country. Austria-Hungary was an enormous empire, and had these plans that they had drawn up to invade Serbia, which they did. The assassination gave them the perfect excuse to put this into action. They had been thinking about this for a long time.
All right. I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Let's continue. The next caller, someone who must be listening online, they're in San Francisco, line four. Hello.
Hey, morning, David and yes. Adam. Good topic. What I wanted to raise was the similarities to today and the types of propaganda that they used. And let me see if I got this straight about Archduke Ferdinand. He was one of the worst scoundrels. He was like a bad drunk, a bad gambler. He ripped off people on a regular basis. He didn't pay his debts, and he refused to pay them, and he used the affairs of government to make sure that he never had to pay off. So he was very costly to every nation, and the diplomatic ties of every country were ruined. But any time he came into the and he liked to travel. So he spread distaste and disgust everywhere he went. And so the idea that actually a war would be fought over his honor was laughable, but it still happened. And so the idea that it was the profiteers that wanted the cost overruns in a war without end. And so that's basically, I'm seeing that in the propaganda today, this war without end, and you're doing top secret contracts with guaranteed profits in a war without end. That seems like a death spiral to me of economics, and I'm just wondering, what were the specific phrases that they used to trick people back then?
The specific phrases they used to trick people back then, well, there were several things people on different sides appealed to. I think when countries go to war, they do so for all kinds of, reasons of greed, paranoia, geostrategic maneuvering for position, but they always talk in much loftier terms. Britain and France tended to talk about they were fighting for the defense of civilization against barbarism. The Russians spoke about, a number of Russian writers, including even people on the left, signed a statement at the beginning of war saying that they were fighting to help the people of Europe throw off the Germanic yoke. Germany claimed that it was fighting in its own defense because France and Russia, who were in alliance, were on either side, And Germany always feared having to fight a two-front war and being crushed by these two powerful nations on each side of them. And then later in the war, they began using the rhetoric that they were fighting for morality and honor against Britain, who emerged really as their most severe enemy, whereas the British were fighting to enthrone the worship of gold. Those are the words of Kaiser Wilhelm II. So countries always grab for what seems to be the loftiest justification for what they're doing. And you see the same pattern today, and you're right about that. I mean, you look at the U.S. invasion of Iraq. At various times, that was justified by different things. First, we were going after these weapons of mass destruction. And then when those were not found, the justification began to shift, that we were combating terrorism, we were bringing democracy to the Arab world, and so forth. But of course, there are powerful strategic reasons involved today, just as then. You know, if anybody thinks that the U.S. was not fighting for strategic and self-interested reasons in Iraq, just stop and think, would we have gone to war in Iraq if instead of being a country whose principal export was enormous quantities of oil, if its principal export was potatoes or turnips or something? I don't think we would have gotten embroiled there.
This does point to, I think, another interesting facet of this, of World War One, and that is that here in the United States, the effort to build support for the war really becomes the beginning of the modern public relations industry.
Very much so. One of the aspects of the war which really fascinated me was that it was really the first propaganda war. Because of the advent of conscription, you know, you needed to mobilize a whole population. And even before conscription in England, for example, when the first year and a half of the war they were running the army totally with volunteers, you needed propaganda to sort of whip up war enthusiasm. And because the war so much involved the civilian population who were mobilized into war industries, each side was doing their best to cut off the food supply to the civilian population of the other side, propaganda becomes tremendously important. And in my book, I'm focused on England, and I try to do so through telling the story of this war and the wartime experience through a collection of characters. One of these characters is a man named John Buchan, who was chief of the British propaganda operation. Very interesting man who was really the inventor of the modern spy novel, best-selling novelist, head for the latter half of the war of the British propaganda effort. He also served at the front as sort of on the staff of the British Army on the Western Front, writing communiques for the press, sort of pushing out propaganda there. He was simultaneously writing dispatches for the Times of London. He kind of wore all these hats, many of them at the same time. And so part of what I'm doing in this book is through him and a few figures like him, looking at what the propaganda operation was that accompanied this war, which was a tremendously important thing on both sides.
Was this, am I remembering right, this was the man who wrote this novel that was extremely popular in Britain that was about Germany invading Britain and really helped to create in the minds of the British people the idea that Germany was a threat?
Yes, it was a novel that actually Alfred Hitchcock made a famous film of it, The 39 Steps, about a German plot on the eve of the war, not exactly to invade, but sort of secretly gathering intelligence that would, you know, at the very highest level that would, you know, allow Germany to strike a terrible blow. And during the war, especially as the war dragged on, and, you know, it was really sort of a stalemate on the Western Front for almost the entire duration of the war, the need to find internal enemies grew. You know, if we're not winning this war, despite, you know, our valiant, brave soldiers and so on, there has to be an internal enemy that's the problem. And there were huge spy scares in Britain. Scotland Yard was getting 300 tips a day about, you know, people who might be German spies that folks had seen. As a matter of fact, there were no actual German spies in England. They had all been rounded up rather efficiently right at the beginning of the war. But this didn't prevent there being spy hunts and a great deal of paranoia on the subject throughout the war, and it made things like spy novels extremely popular.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour. Adam Hochschild is our guest, and we're talking about his new book, To End All Wars. It is about World War I. And we have some other callers here. Let's go to Champagne and Line 2 next. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm an old friend of Mr. Hochschild. I've known him personally and through his work to be a deeply humane and compassionate person. And so I wondered what particularly moved you to write this book when you consider the full range of history. Was it this peaceful, the anti-war groups, or just if you would comment? And secondly, would you kindly comment on the fact that groups who study conflict have documented that there has been a steady decline of war over the past decades? Do you feel that this is a sign that there's less need to find enemies, as you were describing just now, or growing peace and wisdom in the world at large? So if you would comment on both those questions, what particularly moved you to write this book, and also do you feel this trend, this decline, what do you feel that indicates, this decline of war over the past decades? And I'm very, very happy to be in touch with you, Adam. I'll hang up and hear your answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thanks. Let me mention, talk about the second thing first. I'm not sure there has been a decline of war. I mean, you look just at the three different conflicts the U.S. is involved in right now. Iraq, which has been going on since 2003, yes, supposedly our troops will be out of there by the end of the year, but we're going to have a lot of so-called advisors left behind, and I think it will be a long time before the United States is unembroiled from that part of the world. Afghanistan, we have now been involved in for almost a decade, second longest war in American history. That's still going strong, and now we're involved in Libya as well. And in a way, you know, one can't help but sympathize with the people trying to overthrow Gaddafi, certainly a dreadful man if there ever was one. But, you know, many of the folks we're allied with there were people who were very recently part of Gaddafi's government, and nobody knows exactly how that war is going to come out. I also myself have written about, reported from, the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has been in a state of continual war on and off for the last 15 years ago. So I'm not sure that wars in general are on the decline. certainly world wars, you know, that involve many countries and were on a scale of First World War, Second World War, we happily haven't seen another one of them yet, but there's an awful lot of conflicts around the world. But let me turn to the question of what led me to write this book. I think it was the drama of the contrast between the terrible toll wrought by the First World War, the utter senselessness of it, that it was not fought, not a conflict fought for any great purpose. Contrast between that, its tremendous death toll and so forth, and the nobility, I think that's the best word, of the people in all of the warring countries who recognized this as madness at the time and had the courage to speak out, had the courage to refuse to fight at a time when there was a lot of rabid nationalism in the air and when it was very, very hard to be an outspoken critic of the war. I focused on England because that's where the largest anti-war movement was. And as a writer, I guess the narrative challenge for me was, could I make an interesting book in that was describing a movement that failed, because they did fail in stopping the war. but they were noble, extraordinary people nonetheless, and I can't help but admire them. People who had the courage to resist, people who went to jail for their beliefs, people who kept up their spirits in prison by producing at least 8 or 9 known clandestine prison newspapers, often written on toilet paper. I'm fascinated by people like this, and I wanted to tell their story.
Right. We have a couple of minutes yet. We have some other callers, so we'll go next to Niles. This is line 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask a question. My understanding is two things. One, that the Kaiser begged his cousin, the Tsar, not to mobilize. And at the same time, I also understand that the foreign minister of Germany similarly begged the Austrian authorities, the emperor particularly, not to go to war, not to push this to the ultimate, take the concessions that Serbia had made, call it a day. And yet, by and large, most people credit Germany with starting the war. I'm a little confused about some of those facts. So maybe you can confirm whether or not they are erroneous, and secondly, whether that continues to point the finger at Germany as the motivator for the whole thing.
Okay.
Well, you know, there probably has not been a period of history limited in time as intensively studied as that time between the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo on June 28, 1914, and the eruption of a continent-wide war in the first week of August, less than 6 weeks later. And in fact, you look at most of the major powers, and they sort of blew hot and cold during that period. At the beginning of that period of time, the Kaiser, the German government, were eagerly pushing the Austro-Hungarians to retaliate against Serbia fast, use the assassination as an excuse to crush Serbia. And the Kaiser had been a sort of, voice egging on Austria-Hungary in that direction for some years. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, however, was so inept that the leadership seemed to have forgotten, when they started to try to mobilize the army for this effort, that they had given large numbers of soldiers leave to go home and help with the summer harvest. So they couldn't mobilize right away. By a couple of weeks later, when they did start to mobilize against Serbia, at that point, the Kaiser was getting cold feet because he saw that this was likely to lead to a continent-wide war. And at one point, he tried to slow things down. So you can find instances of people blowing hot and cold, same person, during that six-week period. I think Germany, despite what they were saying, really did want a war with Russia. What they didn't want, didn't expect, and didn't plan for was a war with England, because their plan was to crush France swiftly so as to get rid of the opponent on that side, and their long-time plan called for getting all the way to Paris, which would knock France out of the war, in exactly 42 days. Then they were going to turn and put the full bulk of their troops against Russia. But England came in, France resisted more than they had planned for, things didn't work out that way.
We're very short on time, maybe have about a minute. We'll try real quick to get one more caller. This will be Charleston, line 1. Go ahead.
Hi. Sorry, I only have a minute left. The question I really wanted to have you address was the Christmas peace. Did that have an effect on the people who were opposed to this war? And I know you're out of time, so I'll leave it at that.
I wish it had more effect than it did, because it was quite a beautiful thing. In 1914, on the Western Front, Christmas Day, there was a sort of spontaneous, unplanned truce that broke out. British and French soldiers and German soldiers came out of their trenches into no man's land, played some soccer games, shared food, traded gifts, We're photographed standing with each other and chatting, and it's sort of a beautiful moment, and there have been songs about it. Paul McCartney, I think, did a music video about it. There's a lovely moment that, unfortunately, on the Western Front at least, did not happen again. Mm-hmm. There were sort of similar moments of fraternization, which the generals on both sides were very afraid of, that happened on the Eastern Front after the Russian Revolution, when Russia stopped fighting. But in the West, nothing like this ever quite happened again.
You have to wonder, and I can't give you much time, but you really have to wonder, you can understand the conditions that fostered the beginning of the war, but very quickly things settled into a stalemate, and you have to wonder whether at some point, maybe about 2 years in, there wasn't more discussion of the fact that this wasn't accomplishing anything and that maybe it would be a good idea to stop.
If there was ever a war that should have had a negotiated settlement, this was it. And one of the characters I follow to end all wars is a wonderful peace campaigner named Emily Hobhouse, a British woman who was the sole person in Europe during the war who actually traveled from one side to the other to try to see if she could arrange a peace settlement. Went to Germany, through Switzerland, met the German foreign minister whom she'd known before the war, came back to England, tried to see people in the British government, couldn't bring it off, but in a war that killed 20 million people, military and civilian, she was the one person who actually tried, who actually went to the other side.
Well, that story and more can be found in the new book, To End All Wars, by our guest Adam Hochschild. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. And thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you, David. It was good to be with you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. The show was first broadcast on May 6th. Coming up in the second hour today, we'll have another archive, this one from April. Edward Dalnick in this program talks about his book, The Clockwork Universe. It profiles a group of scientists, included among them Isaac Newton, who were actually involved in the inventing of modern science, something that in the process remade our understanding of the world. We're on the web at will.illinois.edu, so you can listen that way. You can go there and see the schedule and find out what we'll be doing tomorrow and the day after that and the day after that, and also listen to past programs that you might have missed a first time around. Here, let me take an opportunity to tell you about upcoming shows. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, this is First Wednesday, and so for a long time it has been our pleasure and our tradition to talk about food and cooking. And so Doyle Moore, the man we call our chef in residence, will be with us once again for a program on talking about cooking. We exchange stories and recipes and cooking tips. And this time around, he said he wants to talk about braising, which is a very versatile technique. You can certainly use it to make the most out of inexpensive cuts of meat. And the great thing about braising is you can do it in the oven, you can do it on top of the stove, you can do it in a crock pot. That's essentially braising. You can even do it on the grill outside. So maybe you have a recipe you can share with us. That's tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour. And then another food topic, but a little bit different, we'll talk in hour number two with Steve Long. He's professor of crop sciences at the University of Illinois, someone who's been involved in research on turning grass into ethanol, and also we'll be talking about what we know about the food system, the demands will be placed on it in the future, and how that may well be affected by global climate issues. That's tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always invite your questions and comments.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting the community to the return of Outside at the Research Park on Friday, July 8th at 7:30 p.m., featuring Del Castillo. More information is available at krannertcenter.com.
And right now we'll take our usual break so we can bring you an update on the markets and some news from National Public Radio, so stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodities, where U.S. wheat futures are 3% higher today. That's their biggest gain in 7 weeks, as demand from overseas buyers is picking up after the prices dropped to 11-month lows last week off the quarterly grains stock and acreage reports. Corn and soybean futures are also up sharply as bargain buyers are entering the market following the sharp declines of last week. The gains are coming amid broad-based support for commodities despite a firming dollar. China has recently purchased as much as 1.8 million tons of new crop U.S. corn, and the expectation is that China might be in the market in the near future